All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I hope you've all served yourself, have a drink in hand, some canapes. Good evening and welcome to the Press Club. It's fantastic to be back. I'm Hervé Lemayeux, the Director of Research at Lowy Institute and the chair of our discussion this evening. Before I go any further, let me acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather tonight, the Ngunnawal. I pay my respects to their elders past and present. It's wonderful to be back in Canberra, and there's a lot, I think, to digest just in the last few months alone. And it's fantastic to have that sort of in-person dimension again, and we'll have a lot of Q&A, so I hope that you've got your questions ready for our panelists. In a few months' time, we'll go to the polls to decide our next federal government. A fraught international environment is challenging the old rule that Australians don't vote on foreign policy questions. Obviously, Russia's shocking and brutal invasion of Ukraine has shown us that the behavior of, frankly, the 19th century can still threaten the international order of the 21st century. Meanwhile, closer to home, Australia's relationship with China is still on ice, with significant implications for our economic prosperity and our security. And the world appears to be settling into a new COVID normal. I wouldn't say we're recovering from COVID, but after two long years, the pandemic can still disrupt, but we are trying to adjust. But we can't entirely foresee how it will evolve. And all the while, the planet continues to heat up with potentially existential implications for many countries in our region. And at home, we're committing vast sums of money to new defense projects with plans to expand the size of our military to its largest since the Vietnam War. So there's a lot to take in, and there's a lot that the next Prime Minister of Australia will have to confront on their first day in office to understand the key issues that will shape both the electoral campaign to come and the international agenda of whoever sits in the lodge in May. I'm joined by three outstanding Lowy Institute colleagues. To my immediate right, Susanna Patton, who is a research fellow and project director in the Power and Diplomacy Program. This is also her debut Lowy Institute event. She joined us recently from the U.S. Study Center. In the middle there, Sam Rogaveen, the director of our International Security Program and our ambassador of the Lowy Institute, local, and Richard McGregor, our senior fellow for East Asia, and our China hands, as it were, big author and analyst. Now, before we move into the substance of the election and to what extent foreign policy will really cut through and dominate, I thought we would just set the scene and have a look at just what has changed in the last 3 months, beginning obviously with Ukraine. The invasion is a clear and horrific violation of the principle of sovereignty and of the legal prohibition of the use of force in international relations. But it seems to be more than that as well. In fact, in the words of Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, I quote him now, "This is not about Ukraine at all, but about the world order. The current crisis is a fateful, epoch-making moment in modern history. It reflects the battle over what the world order will look like." So it's both very much a war taking place in Europe, but one that seems to implicate countries as far afield as Australia in a very direct manner. There's a question here about China. There's a question here about the world dividing into two blocks, but I thought I would pitch my opening question to Sam and just ask, I mean, Sam, what you think, how this conflict will end, essentially. I mean, where is this all leading to? Clearly, the Russians have been upset by their own military setbacks, but brute force may well prevail after all. The West has also had a much stronger reaction than originally anticipated. So where does this all go?
Mm. Well, thank you, Hervé, and thank you to everyone for joining us here this evening. Look, I think the first thing to acknowledge is that we're operating in a very difficult information environment, which is to say that As someone who follows this relatively closely, very closely actually, since the campaign began, it is difficult to know exactly how it's going. very difficult to get reliable statistics, for instance, on military losses, particularly on the Ukrainian side, but also Russian. We see lots of snippets on our social media fields, but feeds, but what it all adds up to is harder to know. So it seems to me that a very broad range of outcomes is still plausible. Everything from Russia achieving enough military advantage to essentially impose a favourable settlement on one end, to at the other end, I would say that to me it feels plausible that the Russian army collapses entirely as a fighting force. I think the one thing we probably can rule out at this stage is that Russia achieves comprehensive victory on the battlefield, defeats the Ukrainian army, and you know, the Ukrainian government essentially collapses and is replaced by a kind of puppet regime. We know enough already to think that that's a very unlikely outcome. And I think probably the most important variable there is that it feels to me like it's going to be impossible for Russia to cut off the supply of arms and other aid that's coming over the western border of Ukraine. And it looks at this point as if that the military aid that's been provided so far, and let's pause to consider 17,000 anti-tank weapons alone within the first 6 days. That's a colossal logistical effort that was put together by the Western powers and has clearly had a major impact, perhaps a decisive impact on the Russian military campaign. So I think we can rule out that option of an overwhelming Russian military and political victory, but you know, a kind of favourable settlement for Russia after a ceasefire and a negotiation, that still feels plausible to me. The other bit of news we got just overnight is that very briefly a Russian newspaper website posted the news that Russia had suffered almost 10,000 killed in the campaign. It's not clear yet how credible that is. The Russian newspaper pulled the statistic down within minutes and claimed that the site had been hacked. Of course, they would say that if they had posted the truth. If that's anywhere near true, then I think we do have to consider the possibility that, well, first of all, it means the military campaign is completely unsustainable from the Russian perspective. And secondly, I think we have to take seriously the possibility of complete Russian military collapse. And one thing I've been saying for a little while now is that while we want Russia to lose, we should be careful about Russia losing by too much. And so if the Russian army completely collapses, if the Russian economy completely collapses as a result of unprecedentedly tough sanctions that are being imposed now, never been tried before, nobody really knows what the effects are going to be, then we do need to consider the possibility of that Russia, that President Putin does what the strategists call escalate to de-escalate, right? Which is to say you use the unthinkable weapons of mass destruction, of which the Russians have many thousands in their armory, use a select few, perhaps just a nuclear test or an actual weapon but on a very isolated target. If that happens, then we're entering entirely new and incredibly dangerous territory, because the Russians, the Putin individually, feel so boxed in that he has no option but to escalate in order to force Ukraine and the Western powers to climb down. So, as I said, I think the principle that the Western leaders should be operating by here is that we want Russia to lose, we don't want it to lose by too much. We need to be thinking beyond, as painful as this is, we need to be thinking beyond the Ukraine campaign to see how much worse this could actually become.
Richard, I mean, to what extent has the Ukraine crisis fundamentally altered the calculus between Moscow and Beijing? How is China looking on at this disaster from its position of pro-Kremlin neutrality? And what does that mean for Russia-China?
Yes, if we were to do this event at the start of the year, which we might have been able to do except for COVID and with the year ahead, and I would have nominated three areas, three prisms, if you like, through which Chinese leaders would have looked at the year. Everything would have to be seen through them. Obviously, the first is The party congress once every 5 years at the end of the year, in other words, securing a third term for President Xi. He's already laid the sort of political groundwork for that. He's laid the policy groundwork for that. He started to do the organisational and personnel groundwork for that. Everything is proceeding to that end. Secondly, the other prism through which all policy is sort of put through, I think, is US-China strategic rivalry, which is obviously hydra-headed, ideological, trade, about the region, military technology, et cetera, et cetera. The third prism is COVID zero. I think China renamed that recently, or relabeled it as dynamic COVID, because they were sort of going to sort of make it more flexible at the edges. But that's gone in the last 2 weeks as one of the Omicron subvariants has begun spreading, I think, into 28 of 30 provinces. In the absence of a good vaccine, a higher level of vaccination, China is stuck with COVID zero and stuck with COVID. But of course, Ukraine has come in and kind of overwhelmed all of that, or to stand alongside of it. So to understand that, you have to understand the China-Russia partnership. Obviously, the Putin-Xi meeting and then the 6,000-word communique they put out after that, you know, which enunciated in great detail the no-limits partnership. I think that's made people sit up and notice, but really this has been coming for a long time. Many people never thought it would reach such a strength, but it's been coming for a long time, really since 1989-90, when the the China-Russia relationship began to be rebuilt. And Hu Jintao, as a leader, nurtured this, but obviously Xi Jinping and Putin have taken it to another level. So there's many reasons for it. Obviously, there's pragmatic reasons. You know, Russia sells arms, oil and gas and foodstuffs. China sends consumer goods, electronics back the other way. But the prime organising feature of it is hostility to the US. And obviously, Xi and Putin agree deeply on that. So it's a relationship not just between two countries, but between two leaders. Hmm. And then, of course, the moment they sign it, we get this invasion. Now, we can talk about what the Chinese knew, but either they had a catastrophic failure of judgment or on the part of Xi, failure of intelligence or on the part of Xi, judgment. You know, if Xi Jinping didn't realise this was going to happen, he's met Putin one-on-one nearly 40 times, you know, talk about not being able to read your colleague or read the room, or they're utterly complicit. And that's why I think the Chinese system is squirming in the face of this, because it goes absolutely against their principle of territorial integrity, sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no way around that for them. For the moment, I think there's, you know, pro-Kremlin neutrality is a nice way of putting it. I think just I'd drop the neutrality bit out of that, because clearly China is not neutral so far. They have adopted the wolf warrior coterie at the Foreign Affairs Ministry, have adopted holus bolus, the Russian conspiracy theories about US biolabs in Ukraine. If they're doing that, you look how they're reporting at the issue to their own people. They don't call it a war, et cetera, et cetera. Most dissenting voices have been sat on. Then I think, you know, they're sticking by Russia. Now, take it out to 6 months if the war is grinding on. You know, I don't believe, as Peter Dutton said, you know, she could pick up the phone and tell Putin to call it off. That's not possible. But China could be influential in 6 months if there's no change, because that will drain political capital from China globally and from Xi domestically. I also don't think China wants to bail out Russia. I don't think they're doing that at the moment, but I don't think they want to do it. That would have little support China at all. And the idea that the story the Americans had about the Russians asking the Chinese for military assistance, it's not entirely clear what they did ask for, But that's just as possible, the Russians holding the Chinese feet to the fire, you know, and saying, you're on our side, you'd better help us. So I think for the moment, China's sticking by Russia. In 6 months' time, they might start to get really worried about it, worried they'd have to support Russia, worried that Putin is going down, worried it's affecting them around the world. I don't believe the world's dividing into two blocks, but we're going to come back to that. And then finally, there are implications for Taiwan, but we might come back to that as well.
Sure. So, Susanna, I mean, this is the million-dollar question, the trillion-dollar question, is whether we are seeing, as in the words of Lavrov, an epoch-making shift, a return to something like the Cold War insofar as it's defined by two mutually exclusive blocks. It certainly seems to be both what's happening in reality as well as mirrored in some of the political discourse that we've seen here in Australia. So the Prime Minister is referring to an arc of autocracy. So to what extent do you think that that mirrors reality? And then what does that mean for Australia?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important to put the Russia's invasion of Ukraine into context about what it means for Australia and why it matters to Australia. Because although there's been the effort to say that it matters to Australia because it's part of a global conspiracy of autocracies working in partnership, I think the reality is actually much simpler. It matters to Australia because, as you said in your opening remarks, Hervé, the invasion of a sovereign country by another larger country is always unacceptable. It should be unacceptable. We're a country that has global interests. And so you don't have to create a conspiracy or slate this back to China's role in the Indo-Pacific to make this relevant to Australia. It already is. And I think the other sort of challenge, as you alluded to in your question, is whether or not this is factually accurate or whether or not this is a bit of a misrepresentation. Because, you know, as Richard set out, it's not at all clear how the China-Russia partnership is going to emerge from this in 6 months' time or in 6 years' time. We just don't know. It's too soon to say whether China and Russia are working hand in glove in the way that this language about an arc of autocracy implies. And I think more fundamentally, it potentially misunderstands the nature of the challenge that China poses in our region, which is a much longer term, more potentially insidious challenge, which relates to China's growing economic influence over time. You know, the reality is China has not launched a wholesale military invasion of one of its neighbours, as Russia has done. And I think it's really important not to overreach there, because when we're talking about the challenge posed by China or Russia to our neighbouring countries or to countries in our region, if we are seen to be overreaching in terms of those linkages and in terms of the challenge posed by China, I think that that undermines our credibility. And then that goes to the point which you raised, Hervé, about is the world dividing? Well, we've definitely seen coming out of this crisis that Western countries, so European countries, the US, are pulling together much more strongly than we expected. But in terms of the role of countries in, for lack of a better word, the global South, you know, most relevantly for Australia in Southeast Asia, it's not at all clear that there is this kind of division between two blocks or that that is a helpful prism for looking at this problem. So, yeah, I would overall come down on being fairly sceptical about the idea of an arc of autocracy.
Interesting. I mean, part of what I think in his speech to the Lowy Institute, the Prime Minister was trying to do was to draw parallels between what's taking place in Europe and what may take place in the Indo-Pacific. And obviously the question then is Taiwan. I mean, does Ukraine in some way serve as a model for how China may go about prosecuting its so-called core interest of integrating Taiwan into the mainland? So do you think China's feeling emboldened here, Richard, and should we be concerned? Or is the fact that it's not ratcheted up the pressure in the last few weeks a sign that it's more conservative than Russia fundamentally?
Well, I bet you China hopes that the invasion of Ukraine is not a model, considering how it's gone. Somebody put it quite well the other day. We've kind of instantaneously moved from a post-war era in Asia to a pre-war era. Mm. In other words, we can see this happening in some form or another in the Asia-Pacific, Indo-Pacific, whatever. I still think the Taiwan issue is, the timing of whatever China does in Taiwan is unrelated at the moment to what is happening in Ukraine. That's a kind of insult to the Chinese. Their timetable is not related to what Russia might do. It might be affected later on if Russia does fall on a heap, because obviously they want support from Russia if anything were to happen in Taiwan. But Taiwan will come to a head at some stage, I believe, without sounding too deterministic about it. I think it's just baked into the cake in internal Chinese politics that Taiwan, as you nicely put it, has to be reintegrated into the mainland, or integrated. You know, there's a question as ever, it's whether never been part of the PRC. There are very different circumstances, but aspects of it do provide a kind of stress test for what might happen there. First of all, it's hard to invade a country. It's hard enough if you drive tanks across the border. It's much harder if you have to grab an island, which is in all likelihood well defended. There's a big debate about whether the Taiwanese can put up much resistance and whether the Americans get there at all. But even if Taiwan loses quickly, that might be where China's problems start. It's possible people in Taiwan, as has happened in Hong Kong, with people of Hong Kong under incredible pressure, it's basically folded. Hong Kong, the government, there's no more dissent there. Hmm. Civil society, it's either wiped out or pro-China. The judiciary, by and large, is now adapting to China. Even the Catholic Church, important parts of Hong Kong society, are sort of succumbing to Chinese pressure. So does that happen in Taiwan? Taiwan now has a deeply democratic culture. It has political parties. It has a strong civil society. It has feisty local governments, clan associations. It has a military. Potentially, of course, has support from the US, direct support, Japan, perhaps Australia and the like. It's not so easy to simply gobble up a country, as Russia is finding, and it won't be so easy, I think, for China to manage Taiwan, particularly as China has basically given up the path of trying to seduce Taiwan at all or persuade Taiwan. It's all about pressure, inducements, psychological wargaming and the like, undermining, turning Taiwan into a kind of Lebanon, as some people in Beijing wanted to do at some stage, sort of bringing the society apart so they can put it back together on their terms. So I think if the Chinese are realistic about it, and if Xi allows this amount of free thinking internally, they would be very worried about what they're seeing with Ukraine, which doesn't mean they won't do it.
Sure. The reason I thought it was important to dwell on Australia's international circumstances before moving into the election is I think it goes to the heart of the issue, which is that if we are moving into a pre-war regional order, isn't it the case then that we have fewer foreign policy options at our disposal, irrespective of whatever differences may or may not exist between the political parties in terms of how they see and interpret the world in terms of their foreign policy? So I'll direct this question to Susanna and then to Sam. But Susanna, do you think that in essence we're left with fewer options, and so in some sense the result of this election will not be that decisive in terms of the overall path of Australia's foreign policy?
I think I would largely agree with that. I think that Australia's options have become quite constrained by the growing polarisation between the US and China, and I think that has left us with a much narrower path to tread. and the fact that Australia doesn't have a pragmatic diplomatic relationship with China, I think certainly limits our ability to play the traditional foreign policy role that we once did. So the kind of institution building role that Australia played in the past with things like APEC or the ASEAN Regional Forum or even the G20, you know, it's hard to see how Australia can play that kind of a role now, given our relationship with China, which is not to say that we should necessarily be doing anything differently, but I think it's a reality that we have to acknowledge. And I think that that is why, if you look at the two speeches by the Prime Minister and the opposition leader, it's pretty clear that foreign policy, in the traditional sense of what we would consider foreign policy, is only a relatively small component of what they're both talking about. They both led on discussing defence policy, and I think in many ways that has become the primary prism that we have started to see the world through. And then when it does come to foreign policy, it's really about a focus on doing more with fewer partners, so more with the US and more with the few countries that are both capable and share our interest in balancing China. And the number of countries on that list is quite small. And, I mean, that's why we're seeing greater investment in the relationships with India and Japan becoming so important, is simply because there's not a great range of other countries that that are really like-minded with us necessarily or that share our strategic circumstances. I think that sort of brings us to the question of bipartisanship, which you alluded to, because in that set of circumstances, it's really important that Australia doesn't further constrain its room for manoeuvre by kind of artificially boxing ourselves into certain foreign policy positions, so that we do preserve some kind of autonomy and room for manoeuvre in future, given what I've set out, as I see it, the quite constrained circumstances that we're in.
Sam?
Well, I mean, I can easily see how it looks that way, that we're constrained, that our choices are more constrained simply because of the rise of China. But that's kind of a choice in itself. You know, the fact that there's so little room between the government and the opposition, and I completely agree that that was clear from the two speeches at the Lowy Institute recently by the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. I mean, that's a choice, and that's a choice essentially that the Labor Party has made for domestic political reasons, that it would prefer not to fight on that ground, not to fight an election on that ground, but on other issues. The fact that we've chosen to invest in nuclear-powered submarines and effectively turn our Navy into a kind of adjunct of the US Navy, that's a choice. That's a choice we've made. There are ways to take on the China challenge that don't involve those kind of choices. And in fact, I would argue that we've demonstrated that that, you know, a possible way forward over the last couple of years in response to China's economic pressure against Australia, where what we've essentially done is relied on our enduring economic strengths, our resilience as a nation, to get through, you know, a pretty concerted Chinese economic coercion campaign, and at the same time get through COVID, which was a much harsher economic test, and we've sailed through it economically. And it's interesting to note, I think, that in all that time, excuse me, since the beginning of the Chinese economic pressure campaign, almost nobody advocated for the idea that what Australia ought to be doing is striking back against China. They put sanctions on us. They put tariffs on us. We put tariffs on them, for instance. The only exception to that is Matt Canavan, who floated that for a little while, but it was never taken seriously. So what Australia has done is taken on the economic field, has taken a fairly low-key approach, relied on its enduring strengths, and essentially adopted an attitude of stoicism. That is, we will get through this. We don't need to make an awful lot of noise about it, but we will get through it. And I think it's working. You know, we are getting through this economic coercion campaign. We are demonstrating to China that we won't be coerced or intimidated. And it's interesting to me that when it comes to our defence policy and our foreign policy, we don't learn the same lessons. In our defence policy, we've decided on a much more aggressive forward-leaning approach where, as I said, we're proposing to buy nuclear submarines that are designed expressly to essentially hem the Chinese Navy in near its bases. We're acquiring long-range cruise missiles for our destroyers, you know, 2,000 kilometres of range that could hit, that if the ships are forward deployed, could hit the Chinese mainland. I mean, I feel like that kind of stoical attitude that we've displayed in the economic sphere, that idea of resilience, that could be applied to our defence policy as well, and yet we've chosen a very different path there. And then lastly, on the foreign policy side, I would say that, again, we've made choices. We've decided that we're all in with the United States. And also, you know, the emphasis on the Quad and on China, on Japan and India, that's a choice. But it seems to me when you look at the world, the regional map from China's perspective, you see great powers all around you that in future are going to, in some way or other, constrain China's ambitions. India, Russia, Japan, the United States in North Asia. The one exception is Southeast Asia, where there is no resident great power in Southeast Asia to constrain Chinese ambitions. And it seems to me it's very much in Australia's interest for Indonesia to fill that role. It doesn't at the moment, but we ought to want it to, and it's the only country with the size and the potential strategic weight to actually play that role in future. And yet again, we've made this choice. We're going to focus on the United States and on the Quad and not on Indonesia. These are all choices that we've decided to make.
Interesting. And that could be the subject of a whole other panel. So unfortunately, we'll have to move on. But I actually wanted to continue on this theme of that sort of martial focus that both the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition have brought to their speeches. It's not so much foreign policy as national security. And, you know, perhaps in line with that sort of, at least a perception that our options are being constrained and the choices have already been made and they're sort of locked in. But to what extent, Sam, or, I mean, I think maybe Richard on this one, is this really going to be a khaki election? I mean, that's how it's been described in the press. But is it a khaki election or is it being run by other things?
Yes, well, I mean, we're going to be two-bit domestic pundits on this, of course, because it's really the political professionals who really know this. I mean, you hear a lot of people loosely talking about this as a khaki election. And maybe we had them in Australia in the First World War or 1966 or 2001. But, I mean, hopefully Lowy will do an event on this soon. But the one people I've spoken to, you know, the focus is COVID, cost of living. The government obviously tried to lift the salience, as the pollsters say, about China in the final week of Parliament. But the fact that they haven't continued at that level of rhetoric, I think, suggests that it didn't really grip. I don't see that. It may be, you know, if the opposition did have a different policy, had not been so spooked by the last election where they had different policies and got belted for it, if they were able to articulate a different foreign policy, then maybe we would have a contest there. But they seem determined not to have that contest. So I do agree it constrains their options later. But for the moment, I don't think we do have that. I don't think people change their votes over China yet. And I don't think people talk about the Chinese vote, quote unquote, in different seats. And that's far too linear. I don't think there's a kind of Chinese vote which votes in bloc because it's a diverse community. So if anybody asked me if we're having a khaki election at the moment, I would say no.
Or not yet.
Yeah, I mean, it can spark up very quickly. Ukraine might have done that, but that's a kind of distant war for Australia, I think. And I don't think that's really at top of mind for voters. If they go into the ballot box and they're thinking about Ukraine, no.
Yeah. Sam and or Susanna, but maybe go to Sam first. I mean, when in your mind was the last time we had an election that was, you know, largely determined by national security issues. And do you also think that the CACI election is the right way of understanding, the right framework of understanding this particular electoral campaign?
Well, I broadly agree with Richard that it's
that
we can't say that yet. It's far too early for that. Look, the obvious analogy is with 2001, the November 2001 election, and already a few political pundits have drawn this comparison, and that was that became known subsequently as the Tampa election because this was the first test at the time, major test of the government's harsh border protection policies. And then, of course, there were the September 11 attacks in New York and Washington. It's pretty clear, in fact, I guess it's almost emphatically clear, I was looking over this again today, over the opinion polling, that Tampa did not swing the election in 2001. So border protection was not a decisive issue. This has become a bit of a myth over the years, a comfortable myth for both sides, actually. On the Liberal side, it became a comfortable myth because it kind of enshrined this idea that John Howard was a political genius because Howard was behind that whole mantra of we will decide who comes to Australia in the circumstances, etc. And on the Labor side, it was a comfortable myth because they lost an election they should have won and they were able to attribute that to the inherent xenophobia of the Australian public rather than look to their own faults. So it made sense for that to become entrenched, but it wasn't true. 9/11, on the other hand, the polling is pretty clear that 9/11 did have a decisive impact and did push Howard's personal popularity very much higher and the government stocks very much higher. And if you're looking for a parallel, I think that's where I would go. I mean, clearly, as I think Richard was saying, Ukraine, the Ukraine invasion is not a direct parallel with 9/11. It is more distant for Australians. It doesn't feel emotionally as resonant as I think 9/11 did 20 years ago. But, should this war expand or get worse in the way that I alluded to in my earlier answer, then, who's to say where that could, how that would centre the campaign to come. I guess the one other just closing point that I'd make, Hervé, is to say that although I just finished saying that border protection and Tampa and so on wasn't decisive in that election, I think there is one little sleeper issue that's potentially significant here, and it's also about border protection, but not so much with regard to refugees as in 2001, but more in regard to border protection against COVID. So for the last 2 years, the Australian government has imposed the most draconian impositions on Australians who want to leave the country and Australians who want to come back to Australia. 30% of Australians were born overseas. Many, many more who were born here have relatives overseas. They've all until quite recently have been unable to either leave the country or re-enter the country. I can't help thinking that that could be a sleeper issue out there that that could wind up punishing the government.
I want to move on to this next big question or next big issue, which is one of bipartisanship. And, I suppose there are multiple angles through which you can tackle that issue. But the first one that I'll ask Susanna, and then if anyone else wants to pipe up, is, whether you think that there are actual substantial differences in worldviews and foreign policy between the two parties that are being somewhat disguised by the inclination by both parties, but particularly Labour, to paint everything as bipartisan and agreed and locked in.
I think there are absolutely differences which are not being currently discussed and aired. One that I would focus on in particular is with regards to aid spending, because it's part of Labor's national platform to increase aid spending from the current level, which is below 0.2% of GDP, to 0.5% of GDP, which is an increase, obviously, that is very, very substantial. And I think that would really, in many ways, if that were realised quickly, which it may not be because Labor has not put a time frame on it, but if that were to come to pass very quickly, then I think that would transform Australia's engagement with South Asia, Southeast Asia, potentially the Pacific, although we're already doing a lot there. And there's a big conversation, I think, that we're not having at the moment about where would be the priority for that increase in aid spending, what should it be spent on, how should that align with our strategic interests. So that's just one example. I'm sure there are others as well, but they're not currently being drawn into focus by Labor.
Do you think bipartisanship is a good thing?
As I said before, I think bipartisanship, which tries to box us in and remove our ability to have some sort of room for manoeuvre, and after an election is a good time to have room for manoeuvre in your foreign policy, I think that kind of bipartisanship is not necessarily in Australia's interest.
I mean, does bipartisanship truly exist? And how durable is it, given how quickly our circumstances have changed?
I'm not really in favour of it. The hasn't been a feature of post-war politics in Australia. You know, Vietnam, communism, the US alliance, the second Iraq War, which Labor opposed, of course, and didn't get any credit for it. It's not. People seem to think it's.
Sacrosanct.
Yeah, it's not sacrosanct at all. And maybe this is a particular time and there can be a value in it in some respects, but not to the point where it stifles all debate. You know, if people have a different view on China and people immediately question their patriotism, which is the position we got to in some respects. Is the Labor position on China really different from the government's? Many people would have thought that Labor's had a sentimental view of China. They think they created the relationship, a bit of the old socialist brotherhood, all that sort of stuff. But I think that's real, you know, and of course, Labor also is, has been more suspicious of the US, more of a believer in multilateralism and the like. But I think the sort of sentimentalism of Labor towards China is being squeezed out now on human rights issues. On the unions and jobs, which is much more a factor since China joined the WTO and became the workshop of the world and the manufacturing powerhouse, and of course recent economic coercion and the like, which I think has made China a big negative amongst the population as well, which it makes it difficult to argue for a better relationship. And also, when I moved back to Australia about 4 years ago and you just looked at the day-to-day headlines, Taiwan, Hong Kong, South China Sea, Huawei, Mac, what's his name, the swimmer fighting against the Chinese swimmer down at that level, Mac Horton, just about every single which way there was an antagonistic relationship. And so I think that's brought two major parties much closer together. And since they're much closer together, that should allow for some debate. Since their core interests are the same, but that's not the way it's developed in Australia. In fact, it's diminished the debate.
Mm. Sam?
Well, I'm a bit of a bipartisanship skeptic as well. I do think it diminishes the debate and it locks the public out. I understand this is a deeply ingrained habit for the Labor Party in particular. I mean, don't forget the Labor Party split in the 1960s over the issue of communism and kept it out of power. The split kept it out of power for a decade and a half. So these kind of habits are deeply ingrained, and I understand why they do it. If anything, what worries me more is what you might call tripartisanship, which is the sense that the public service jumps in as well and says, no, we can't have this. So you've got serving and former senior officials coming out and saying, this is too important to be fighting about publicly. And I really do think that that's a little bit, uh, that that it truly locks out the public. It says this is a conversation that happens between people who know what they're doing, between us elites, and it kind of, you know, it pushes the public off to one side. I think there's a slightly anti-democratic tinge to it. On your earlier question, Hervé, about what actually separates the parties, I do think if the Labor Party wins that there's going to be a more sceptical eye cast over AUKUS and the submarine deal in particular. I think there is a group within the Labor Party that's extremely sceptical. And so I would expect, if not a formal review, then certainly a much more sceptical eye to be cast over over the agreement. And, you know, I mean, the project, it's going to take so long to deliver that whoever wins, it's going to be almost impossible to escape the need for an interim submarine. I think the Labor Party's going to cast an eye over that project.
It's really interesting. And a very controversial, somewhat provocative take in the heart of Canberra to be saying that bipartisan is a problem. There's a whole interesting thing there as well in terms of the interventions made by Mike Burgess, the Director General of ASIO. Two interventions, in fact, the first to warn about foreign influence and the second to sort of correct the record and insist that it shouldn't be politicized. There's a whole other story. I think it strikes me that we swing between extremes on the one hand saying this is the preserve of the elite and then we popularize and politicize national security, but it should be somewhere in the middle. But I will open the floor now to questions from the audience. There's much more we could be talking about, so I'm looking for a good steer in terms of your questions. We've got about 15 minutes or so. And I see a hand raised there. There's a microphone coming to you. If you can just identify yourself.
Yeah. Bruce Clark. Yeah. I'm just interested, looking at the current situation in Ukraine, despite the terrible antagonism between European leaders and Putin, we've seen those leaders, and particularly Macron, speaking regularly to Putin. Using that as an example, should the incoming Australian Prime Minister, instead of playing dog in the manger with China, actively try and have some summit with the Chinese leadership?
Well, I think, you know, if there's a real, you know, there might be dog in the manger if you use that word in both capitals, frankly. If you look at the new Chinese ambassador, Mr. Xiao, who's been here recently, he sees the foreign minister, he sees business leaders, he sees anybody he wants in the country. That'd be great if that was reciprocated in Beijing, because, of course, our ambassador can barely see anybody, even scholars, even non-party affiliated scholars. So this is not the fault of on one side. But to take your point, Macron talking to Putin hasn't done much, but in the case of China and Australia, I don't think we'll see any movement for any real talks on any things we can talk about. See climate change if Labor got in. The Pacific, for example, we both might have an interest in the Solomon Islands in particular, unless there is a discussion at the top, because unless there's a discussion at the top, the officials down below will not be empowered to do anything and won't be able to do anything. So, yes, it would be better if we had some sort of political relationship. I don't know whether that's going to lead to a strategic understanding, but that's the only way that the rest of the system could end up dealing with each other.
Yes, there's a hand there by the...
Hello, my name's Danisa and I'm from the South African High Commission. Susanna, you're very impressive. Congratulations, you're going to be on many more panels. This might be the last time I speak publicly, but I will ask anyway. I'm from the South African High Commission, and one of the things that I've noticed since arriving on my posting about 10 months ago is that, as Hervé said to us last week in Sydney, there's definitely been a contraction in Australian foreign policy. Instead of approaching the region and the Indo-Pacific, there's more often, one does not want to use the word insular focus, but a focus more on domestic rather than other international priorities, and two regions in particular, the one I come from, Africa and Latin America. In analyzing the different strategies for Pretoria, one notices that two of the major parties don't really have a specific or coherent Africa strategy. I think I know the answer, but is that deliberate? Thank you.
Does anyone want to venture that?
Well, it's not going to satisfy you, but I don't think any Australian government should be embarrassed about not prioritising Africa and Central America or South America. Latin America, forgive me. I mean, if anything, I would argue that our emphasis on Europe since the Ukraine war began has been too strong. You know, the government will say that, you know, this was an incredible breach of international norms and an act of aggression, and that's true. But for goodness sake, the United States just declared that there is an actual genocide occurring in Myanmar. And I think so far we've taken more action on sanctioning Russia than we have on sanctioning Myanmar. So I don't think any Australian government ought to be embarrassed about focusing on its neighbourhood, and we ought to be actually taking stronger steps to fully recognise the fact that we are an Asian nation, we are a Pacific nation. This is our home, and this is where our foreign policy should be focused. I'm sorry, that's an unsatisfying answer for you, but I'm afraid that's how I feel.
I might add quickly. Yeah. I think it's not entirely clear, but I think Australia and South Africa have different views of China these days, different ways of handling China. If you read the China-Russia statement, BRICS made a big comeback in that. BRICS was kind of dying, I thought, but there was a commitment in there to the annual BRICS summit, which was interesting. Plus, I think South Africa's view on Ukraine has been quite different from Australia's as well. So there's kind of a divergence of views as well. Now, that doesn't mean the two sides wouldn't be close and the like. But it is looking like we've got a lot of sport in common and not much else.
I might just add to that quickly, and I mean, this is beyond the chair's capacity, but anyway, I will speak as almost as a honorary fourth panelist. But I do think I'd actually disagree with Sam. I think there was a time when we defined ourselves as a global middle power, and that is a loss to our foreign policy. That the Indo-Pacific was not so much an expansion of our horizons as a contraction, and that if anything, Ukraine reminds us of just how interconnected and global everything is. Now, I don't necessarily take it in the sense of a new Cold War. I mean, although whether we like it or not, we might have to accept it. That really depends more on Russia and China. But certainly in terms of our engagement with the non-Western world, what Susanna has referred to as the global South, we're missing a third dimension there in our foreign policy, and that transcends the Indo-Pacific, and that goes as far afield as Africa and Latin America. So I'm not sure if this is on the cards. It's certainly not an electoral issue, but I do think it will be something to think about when the next government comes to power, or if this one is re-elected. And I have a question from the Ukrainian chargé d'affaires.
Yes, thank you. Just continue the story. I arrived 2.5 years ago, and it was really striking to me that within DFAT, it was Department of Latin America and Eastern Europe. So it was a sense of priority in terms of foreign policy. Now we have entire department devoted to Ukrainian issue within DFAT. But my question relates to the kind of your perception of Labour Party position on Ukraine. Thank you.
I'm not aware of any particular differences there. Maybe you should answer that yourself. But I don't think I haven't seen any major differences? I mean, there's obviously, as we've seen because of the unfortunate events of the recent weeks about, you know, debate inside Labor on human rights policy generally internationally, but I'm not sure that affects Ukraine, so we better talk about that after.
Yeah, I can't add much to that. I've seen no evidence of any kind of divergence between the two sides, and I think I understand that President Zelensky is due to speak remotely to the Australian Parliament. Is that correct in coming weeks?
We are working on it.
If that happens, I think you're going to see, you know, the two sides in absolute lockstep on in every major respect. Yeah.
There's a question at the back there, gentlemen, at the back.
Thank you, John Murray. Mention has been made tonight regarding AUKUS and the Quad. But France, for example, has got more territories, more naval surface vessels, more tactical aircraft, and more political influence in the Pacific region than has the United Kingdom. Was ever any consideration given to inviting France to become part of what was now known as the Quad?
Sammy, you want to take that?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't think there were any such considerations ever. It's interesting to reflect now after the events of the last 3 weeks about Europe's place generally in the Asia Pacific. It seems to me it's going to be much diminished. I can't see. There are others in the audience here who can speak with much more authority on the future of France's Pacific territories. But in terms of France being a major strategic power in Asia or in the Asia Pacific and the UK being a major strategic power in the Asia Pacific, I think the events of the last 3 weeks have transformed that entirely. And I think now we ought to, as Australians, basically write off that possibility entirely. I mean, before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Australia's Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, was talking about the possibility of British nuclear submarines docking regularly at Australian ports. Well, I think they're going to be busy now.
Yeah, I think the origins of the Quad at the post-tsunami in, was it 2003, and Japan and the free and open Indo-Pacific, and that's where it came from, I think. And I think at that stage there was little interest from Europe or in Europe. And I don't think the French would have joined the Quad anyway. They might join on some programs now, as South Korea is looking at and the like, as the UK is looking at, but I don't see them as a fully fledged partner.
Susanna, did you want to add anything on the EU?
No, I mean, I think, Australia very much wants, and as Sam mentioned, you know, pre-Ukraine crisis, wanted to see a stronger role for European countries in Asia. But it's possible to put what you said about France's presence the other way around, which is to say France already has such an extensive military presence in its Pacific and Indian Ocean territories, yet it's not tipping the balance strategically in Asia. So what more are European countries likely to do, whether France, UK, Germany, any others? I would, even before this crisis of European security, have been pretty sceptical about that. And I think Australia should have pretty well-calibrated ambitions in that regard.
Yeah, again, if I may, as you know, not as a panelist rather than a chair, but I think with, you know, a broader European level and at a global, I mean, I sort of agree with you to an extent. I mean, militarily, the focus will be on Russia. But don't underestimate what this crisis has done to awaken sort of a geopolitical European Union, right, in ways that have not really happened before. We'll have to see whether that's durable, but if it is, then I think the EU as a sort of third pole between China and the United States, and that EU-China dynamic matters. It matters for the world, but it matters for Australia. So it may not be in terms of the Indo-Pacific strategy. It may not be in terms of the number of boats that France has in the South China Sea, but that EU-China dynamic matters for the world and therefore matters for us, I think. Further questions? Yeah, one question to the left.
Thanks very much. Just a question on that note, really, or building on it. We've seen increasing attention over the last several years from European states in engaging in our region. The UK Integrated Review and the Global Britain strategy are evidence there, as well as French behaviour and US behaviour in the last couple of years. You've talked a little bit about how we can take advantage of that or how we should respond. What can we do to protect the agency of smaller states in our region, particularly Pacific Island states, who are managing that increasing attention to the region as well?
Is that one?
It's a very good question. And I think, you know, it's important, but I think maybe my answer to that is that, you know, we need to remain focused on the partnership, on our partnerships with countries in the Pacific and with our region as the sort of primary things that we have control over and that we're able to influence, rather than putting too much expectation on external partners coming in there. And I think that's going to be a challenge because you know, even though, for example, the Labour Party has said they would do more in Southeast Asia, they're going to be facing the same strategic dynamics that the current government faces, which is that we don't necessarily get the kind of geopolitical bang for our buck that we're seeking when we engage with Japan or India or other partners who align with us strategically. So I think that's going to be the big challenge for our foreign policy making, more so than for external partners who are coming in as relative newcomers to the region.
All right. Well, look, we're basically out of time. I don't want to end on such a pessimistic note, though. So I wanted to ask very, very briefly if you can answer in 10 seconds or less. If there's one issue that the next government should pursue in its international agenda, what should it be?
Oh, well, gosh, becoming a genuine energy superpower.
Okay.
Indonesia, I think that's I mentioned the reasons earlier that I think this is the sort of latent great power in our region and a potential bulwark against China becoming the dominant power in maritime Southeast Asia. That's where our diplomatic attention ought to be.
I should have said green energy superpower.
Yeah, that's how I understood it as well, but good clarification, Susanna.
Well, I would add to energy superpower, education superpower. You know, I think we need to take another look at the role that Australian education plays in our influence in the region, because it is something that we're known for and we could be doing a lot more.
All right. Well, thank you to my excellent panelists and to everyone here for joining us this evening. As I said earlier, it's a great pleasure to be able to travel again for events like this. Originally, we were meant to have a fourth panelist. Unfortunately, Jennifer Sue couldn't make it tonight due to COVID in the family. But, you know, despite some adversity, we plowed ahead because we think these things are certainly worthwhile. So thank you very much. Please enjoy a drink and we can continue some of this discussion informally just as we mingle after this event. So thank you. Bye.